Thank you for the opportunity to give this talk, and also thank all of you for making it to the end. As you mentioned, I'm here at the University of Waterloo. Just the home audience won't hear. All right, let's see. Okay, try that again. So I'm Alan Jamieson from the University of Waterloo, and I wanted to tell you about some work that's being done in a continuing collaboration with the Ketterle Group at MIT, looking at ultracold chemistry in the sodium-lithium system. Now, as a physicist, when I come to talk about chemistry, I feel like I need to sort of make a standard disclaimer. Okay, I'm going to give you maybe a simplified view of chemistry. So here's my view of chemistry. You have scattering, right? You have reactants, which is your initial state, you have products, which is your final state, and something exciting happens in the middle. That's our scatter. Okay? And to not sort of take too much away from chemistry here, right, for most of the talk, I'm going to be focusing on a diatomic molecule reacting with an atom. Okay, so we've got reactants, products, and it comes together and does a very complicated dance before the reaction is over. Now, that's 3 atoms total. This is chemistry, right? So something big, complicated. This is a kinesin protein walking down a microtubule. This is happening inside of your body right now. I hope that's not alarming. But at the end of the day, there's something very local driving most of this, okay? There's a little conformational change when this thing reacts with ATP that sort of flips that foot out and starts this walking process. So even very complicated chemistry, in many times, has an important local component. And so thinking about these small reactions, in principle, can lead us to understanding of maybe not that big, but bigger chemistry in the end. Just to set the scales here, when we're thinking about molecule structure, we have different energy scales at play. That's not showing up. OK. So we have this sort of large scale electronic potentials. When we think of the splittings there, we're thinking of things like 10,000 Kelvin between the ground and excited electronic states. Within those potentials, we have vibrational states that are split by, you know, Kelvins to hundreds of Kelvins. We have rotational levels on top of those that are running less than a Kelvin, up to a Kelvin, roughly speaking, particularly for low rotational states that we'll be looking at. And then hyperfine structure is somewhere in the sort of maybe as low as a microkelvin for singlet molecules, though we'll be looking at triplet state molecules. The point being, all of these sort of energy scales are well above what we're looking at for ultracold molecules. Okay, so we can control the state of our reactants with sort of arbitrary precision. Okay? We can even control the center of mass motion by changing the temperature of the system. So ultracold chemistry is really sort of all about control. And that's one takeaway from ultracold chemistry. The other is that it sort of exaggerates the importance of that close-range interaction. And one nice way to visualize this is from a paper from John Bowen's group from 2014, is when we're looking at an atom-molecule reaction, as I said, it's just 3 atoms, but you know classically the 3-body problem can get pretty exciting, much more so than the 2-body problem, right? And as you cool, which is to say you lower the collision energy, the time scale for that short-range dynamic grows very rapidly. Okay? And so you can see, as he takes the simulations down to lower and lower collision energies, eventually the collision just doesn't end during the time of the simulation. So on the 1 Kelvin spot there, that's not like some kind of censorship curve. The 3 particles cover the entire space repeatedly and, as I said, don't escape in the time scale of the simulation. So we can really sort of enhance the complexity by going to ultracold temperatures. So just to tell you sort of who the players are here, we're looking at ultracold triplet sodium lithium. So the triplet part is important. I'll come back to this, but you see this sort of red interaction potential there. There's a much deeper singlet potential, which means triplet sodium lithium is not chemically stable. It can always, in principle, get into the singlet potential. And to make these triplet sodium lithium molecules, we follow a kind of what's become a fairly standard story of magnetic association and then steer up to the ground state. I want to talk about the magnetic association for just a moment because it brings in a key idea that we'll come back to a little later, which is the Feshbach resonance. Okay? So the idea here is that we have an avoided crossing between a molecular state and a free atomic state. Okay? And as we sweep magnetic field, the molecular state's energy comes up, the atomic state's energy comes down. They would have had a crossing, but some coupling turns it into an avoided crossing. And as you can see, these two states are in different potentials, right? You wouldn't have a bound state and a free state in the same potential. And so as we tune the magnetic field, right, the potentials are tuning relative to one another. And so on resonance, we've brought the bound state in one potential to the same energy as our free atoms in our entrance potential. Now, for making molecules, we start above the resonance with this atomic state, sweep adiabatically through, and create molecules. Okay, so that's one way that Feshbach resonance is useful. But you could also think the position where that crossing occurs is a very precise spectroscopic measure of the energy of that molecular state. Okay, and so we'll come back and use this to learn more about what's going on in our ultra-cold chemistry. Second stage is to use a two-photon process to convert the sort of weakly bound molecule we can make through Feshbach association into the ground state molecules we want to work with. And again, before we talk about the chemistry, I'll just emphasize, we're working in the triplet potential, so it's not sort of as highly excited as everyone's Rydberg atoms that I've enjoyed hearing about this week, but it is an excited potential. This is not the absolute ground state. Okay? And so that means we can potentially have chemical reactions that are quite exothermic, particularly on the scale of ultra cold, right? So if I start with my triplet sodium lithium molecule with spins pointing up and a sodium atom with its spin pointing up, there's sort of three things you could do just by taking your toys and putting them together in different ways. Two of them are extremely exothermic. So one is that a spin in the molecule could flip, go into that deep singlet potential, and you have a lot of energy available. I always put this in inverse centimeters so that someday a chemist will think I know what I'm doing. Inverse centimeter is 30 gigahertz. So this is like thousands of Kelvin of energy available. Okay. Another thing that could happen is a spin could flip on one of the sodium atoms in particular, make a singlet sodium 2 molecule. Again, 1,000 Kelvin of energy available. So this reaction should definitely be able to go. The third thing we could do is just the exchange reaction. So go from triplet sodium lithium to triplet sodium 2. But that is endothermic, and we don't have any collision energy. We're at a microkelvin. This would need kelvins of energy. So two of the reactions require a spin to flip. One does not, but can't happen. And so the question is, energetically, these are certainly allowed, but do they actually happen? And that's really a question about this dynamics at short range in the collision complex. Can these spins flip? Sort of this, the standard models for thinking about this ultra-cold reactions in a collision complex would say the atoms spend so much time together, there's so much that can happen, will happen. Okay? So we would expect to see these reactions happen. Now if we start instead of in the totally stretched state with all the spins pointing up, electronic and nuclear, then we're looking not in the stretched state to start with. So this is sort of the smallest tilt of the spin of the sodium atom. So instead of the highest Zeeman sublevel, the next one down. And what we see is very fast chemical reaction. So these things disappear very rapidly from the trap. But now if we look in that stretch state where all of the spins are aligned, the reaction rate drops quite dramatically. And in fact, this reaction rate is not so much faster than if we just leave the molecules to their own devices. Just a sample of molecules on their own, they have a very slow reaction with one another. It's suppressed by polyexclusion because these are fermionic molecules. But so we see this sort of smallest tilt to the spin that we can do quantum mechanically makes a huge impact on the reaction rate. It in fact makes such a big impact that we can now use those stretched states to do sympathetic cooling. Okay. So when we make the molecules, the potential changes suddenly. Okay. Basically, the molecules are more polarizable than the atoms. And so in that two-photon process to become molecules, they suddenly find themselves in a different trap, which gives them more energy. And so the molecules start out hotter than the atoms that are left behind. And what we see is this time series. In blue is if we make the molecules and immediately blow away the sodium. And in red is if we make the molecules and leave the sodium behind. And what we see is very clearly the molecules are cooling down to meet the sodium. We did the reverse experiment. After letting it cool, we parametrically heated the sodium, and we saw the molecules rise back up in temperature to follow the sodium again. And from these equilibration times, we can figure out the rate of elastic collisions and compare it to our inelastic loss, which we see in the little loss curve in the top there. What we find is that we get about 80 elastic collisions per reactive collision. Now, for comparison, one step down, that almost stretched state, has a rate of less than one elastic collision per reaction. So essentially, every collision is a reaction and loss in that system. Here we now have 80 elastics per reaction. So if we have a system that's suddenly more stable, we can start wondering about things like resonances. Okay? So for the non-stretch state where we see a reaction in every collision, we have something that's basically, we can model with a mirror, okay? Just one mirror. And so if you're looking at this molecular potential, at long range, you have sort of quantum reflections off the potential. And whatever makes it through into the inner potential, you know, it's got to turn around when it hits that sharp wall at the inside. So you might think this is like two mirrors. Be a pretty simple model for scattering, it's two mirrors. But actually, it's simpler than that because everything is lost at short range in the non-stretched state. And so it's really just like one mirror. Okay? If anything gets to short range, if anything makes it through that first mirror, it's gone. Okay? So that's our slightly tilted spin. But once we have the stretch state and we are getting return from short range, now you've got two mirrors. And if you've got two mirrors, that could be a resonator. Okay? So now we can look for resonances like these atomic Feshbach resonances, but for an atom-molecule collision. And now one of the things that's very surprising about this is by going to the stretch state, we've reduced the loss at short range, right? We say, hey, not every collision leads to a chemical loss. But if we find a resonance condition, we can actually enhance the loss rate well above what we have in the non-stretch state. And the idea is that on resonance, just like with an optical resonator, you draw a huge, not electric field into the cavity, but you draw a huge amplitude of the wave function into the short range where the loss occurs. And so sort of counterintuitively, by having less loss at short range, you can get faster loss. And similarly, if you tune away from resonance, the thing that would make more sense, which is the loss goes down, you see this as well. And so the payoff of this sort of simple Fabry-Perot picture of these resonances is something like this. So in the non-stretch state where you have sort of loss with every collision, this follows something called the universal limit. Okay, it's sort of, you can calculate exactly what the reaction rate would be. That's the dashed black line there. And you can see for the stretch states, the background level is much lower than that. We see much slower reactions. But on resonance, we can actually boost well above that level. And in fact, in some sense, this resonance is blunted by the unitary limit, which is sort of the absolute bound from quantum mechanics on how quickly these reactions can occur. So this sort of nice big blue resonance in the middle there really fits this paradigm of just an optical resonator with a little bit of loss on one mirror. There's also, to the side there, this much smaller black resonance, or resonance in the black data. And that resonance has an underlying collision complex or three-body bound state that has a short lifetime. And based on the way that it's enhanced, we can fit that to a model and extract the lifetime of that bound state, about 60 nanoseconds. Okay? Whereas the other resonance has a much longer lifetime, well into the microseconds. So this is telling us a couple of things. One, it's telling us that there are stable collision complexes in this system that's reactive, has no business being stable. And it also is telling us the positions of those. So a couple of ongoing questions that we're working on answering. One is, if we really view these resonances as a way of doing spectroscopy on deeply bound three-body states, what can we learn? And that's the resonance we were looking at is circled, but you can see there's lots of them. And by looking at the densities of these and connecting with calculations from our theory colleagues on scattering in different potentials, we can start learning really exactly what kind of couplings are being allowed that lead to these losses. We've also looked at the lower stretch states. They also have a really reduced reaction rate that allows us to find collisional resonances, and there's a bunch of them there as well. So trying to put all of this together with theory work so that we can learn more about what's actually going on in this collision complex is one of our ongoing efforts. The other was to look for a resonance between molecules, which had not been seen before. And there's one. And this is the only one that we see in the system. Over a span of 1,400 Gauss, there's one, and it's like 20 milligauss wide. And so this is work that should be on the archive soon. But trying to model this resonance, turns out it goes a little bit beyond this sort of simple picture that I gave you of two mirrors. But I think I'm short on time, so I will just show the team. Hilmok was the senior student leading the earlier work on sympathetic cooling. And Julie is leading the work on the molecular resonance. She did this crazy scan of 1,400 Gauss and found one little tiny resonance in there. Not hundreds like you might find with dysprosium. And with that, I will just mention that I am up the road now at the Institute for Quantum Computing. And now that you've seen what a great place Waterloo is, hope you'll send some of your students my way. And I'll take questions. Thanks.
Questions?
Thanks, Alan. So the two-body picture of the Feshbach resonance that you presented at the beginning sort of connects every Feshbach resonance to one particular bound state with the quantum numbers that you can, in principle, assign, yes. Although in dysprosium, it's impossible
it's
to
immense.
Do that.
It's a mess, right, yeah.
Because there are so many, yes. Yeah. But, I mean, if you have now such a single resonance for molecule, I mean, it's a four-body problem, yes. Can you now say, I mean, it's very narrow, can you now hope to say that there is a set of quantum numbers for these four particles that you can assign to that resonance, or is it something else that is?
Yeah, so you can certainly hope to. So what we're looking at now, this resonance has a sort of very funny character. It shows up at a place where another hyperfine state of the system crosses, or very close to the crossing. But we've run through the calculations, and there's no way to get a resonance this strong for just some sort of like long-range spin flip or something like this. So it looks like what's happening is there is a long-lived complex that couples both to our entrance channel and to this other hyperfine state that's coming through. And so based on that, we're sort of working on understanding what that underlying complex could be. We haven't gotten
that
to the level.
That could be an intermediate sort of metastable, whatever type
right.
of complex, and it's not really
yeah,
connecting to one final state in the end, or am I wrong? Or
well, so it's... The most likely answer is that it's some kind of shape resonance behind the P wave barrier because we've got fermionic molecules. Uh-huh. And so the model that we've worked up would say there's a resonant state that doesn't tune with magnetic fields, so it should have the same magnetic moment as the entrance channel, but still couples to this other hyperfine state for decay process. And the resonance is actually not so much bringing the other bound state into resonance with the entrance channel, but rather opening up the lost channel into this other hyperfine state. So it's a bit funny, and we're working
for
with
the three-body thing that the three-body resonances that you showed, like with one molecule and one atom. That's the same kind of reasoning, or
yeah. So for those, it's more clear that these are like fairly deeply bound three-body states, just based on we're tuning with the upper stretch state, so there's not like another channel above it unless it's got, say, rotational excitation in the complex. And if it's a rotating complex, we know what the asymptote is, and you can say, okay, we're pretty deeply bound, you know, tens of gigahertz bound. So there we think, yes, this is definitely tuning between three-body bound states. but can I go in and say this one has these quantum numbers and this one, no. And that's, you know, we're collaborating with a few different theorists on different aspects of this, and no one wants to tell us, oh, these are the quantum numbers, yes, we've got it. But I think that would be, you know, one would hope that in the long run you can get that kind of understanding. But I think that's still a ways away.
Cool.
Another one up there.
Thanks. So my question is kind of related, but mostly because I didn't quite understand. So is the resonance a resonance of two molecules, or is it a four particle? So is it?
So, well, yeah. So in the molecule-molecule resonance, I think there's still something of a question. I mean, it's a resonance between two molecules in the sense that we've tested that it follows the right two-body loss form, that it has the right scaling to a temperature for a P-wave collision and these sorts of things. So in that, and you know, made sure we cleaned out all the atoms. So it's definitely molecule-molecule resonance. But if the question is this some deeply bound thing where the molecules have sort of lost their character and you really can just say it's four atoms, that part I think is not so clear. It may, I'd even say it's most likely a P-wave shape resonance.